You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for joining me again this week for all the news about law enforcement and the men and women who serve. Before we even get into the briefing room, there's one thing I would ask of you, and that is to check out thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for our organization that assists injured and disabled law enforcement officers. If you haven't seen this website yet, I ask you to check it out. If you are a law enforcement officer, if you have been a law enforcement officer, and you have some things going on where you think it would be helpful to talk to someone who has been there, that's what we exist for. We have a fully trained peer support team. All of these officers have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up, and screwed over. And this includes not just physical injuries, but emotional injuries as well. Reach out. We are at thewoundedblue.org, and just contact us, and we'll have one of our peer team members contact you. Now let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. If you've listened to this program for any length of time at all, you know that I don't pull any punches when it comes down to my views about law enforcement leadership. The unfortunate reality is that many of the law enforcement leaders in major metropolitan areas are letting their people down. Not because they are incompetent, basically, although that is sometimes the case, but it's because of politics and because of how their views of the situations that are taking place in their communities are colored by the political aspirations and complications. Now, I don't know what the deal is with the Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall. After this comment, I got to wonder whether she is incompetent or just politicized, because she came out with a beauty. And I've been hearing a lot of negative things about her from law enforcement officers down in Dallas PD. But so I've been kind of keeping my eye on her. But this was a beauty. She came out publicly, and she said that basically offenders are, quote, forced, unquote, to commit crimes due to a lack of job opportunities. Things that make you go, hmm? So here's the headline. Dallas chief says criminals are forced to commit violent acts and blames society. Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall drew the ire of citizens and law enforcement groups on Monday when she implied that society is to blame for forcing criminals to commit violent acts. And there's a video attached to this. I ask you to, you know, check it out. Go to bluelivesmatter.blue and you can see this video. Here's what she said. There are socioeconomic issues that are related to crime in individuals in this city. There are individuals in the city who have returned from prison who cannot find a job, who are not educated. In those instances, these individuals are forced to commit violent acts. Okay, what happened to accountability? What happened to personal accountability? No one is forced to commit a crime. There are more economic programs out there and welfare programs and assistance programs for the community members than you can shake a stick at. No one is forced to commit a crime, especially a violent crime. Who's forced to commit rape? Who is forced to commit an armed robbery? It's nonsense. And this police chief, by coming out with a nonsensical statement like that, first of all, it makes her look like an idiot. Secondly, it erodes the morale of the police officers in Dallas, who look at their quote leader unquote and go, "What are you talking about? No one is forced to commit a violent act," and to say so devalues the people who are struggling out there and making ends meet every day by working hard and doing what they need to do without committing violent crimes. So I'm going to guess here. I've heard that she is politician first, police chief second. Judging by a statement like that, that would kind of tend to indicate that statement might be correct. But in any event, just another law enforcement leader who reveals some certain inadequacies, if you will. I'll be polite. Now let's go to California. Every story I seem to do that is really something that makes you go, either comes out of New York or comes out of California. Well, here's one out of California. About 80 students involved in a brawl with police at a California high school. Several students tried to pull an officer off a student who was resisting arrest, causing a brawl with about 80 students, police, and staff. So this happened in Bear Creek, which is near Stockton. Bear Creek High School was placed on lockdown after as many as 80 students were involved in a physical altercation with police as they detained one student for fighting staff. So a school resource officer was investigating an assault against several staff members at the school. He was trying to detain the suspect, who was a student. Well, once again, we had a student who refused to be compliant and fought with the police. Now, when the officer tried to take him into custody, what happened? He had to call for help. He had to call for help because he found himself surrounded by a violent, hostile crowd. And if you want to say, well, hell, they're just students, have you any idea how many 14, 15, and 16-year-olds commit incredibly violent acts, including murder, sexual assault, armed robbery, aggravated assault? It happens all the time. So the age of the offender doesn't matter one little bit. If an individual is going to resist arrest, if they are going to become physically violent against a police officer, they should face the consequences. In this particular case, more officers had to respond. It was an incredible melee. And what it reveals is how even these students have been so indoctrinated with entitlement that they no longer fear the consequences of their actions. They're not afraid of the police. And quite honestly, you should be afraid of the police when it comes down to committing violent acts or resisting arrest. You know, if there are no consequences, we know, as unfortunately as human beings, that people will push the envelope. Well, that includes violence as well. So these officers were facing an exceedingly dangerous situation when they were involved in this crowd. And here's the deal. When people are involved in a crowd situation, that is a mob situation, that's exactly what this was, those who would not have acted in a certain way, a violent way, by themselves, find themselves doing things within that mob that they probably would never have thought themselves capable of. That's the mob mentality. It's very real. It's very dangerous. And these officers were forced to protect themselves when it came down to taking the prisoner and getting the prisoner out of there. Here's the unfortunate thing. This was basically downplayed by the school and by the local government. And, this is something that is, should not be brushed aside or pushed under the rug. This is a serious, serious situation. And these officers have every right to defend themselves using any amount of force needed. And that includes deadly force. But can you imagine if one of those officers had used deadly force because they feared for their life? I can't even imagine the headlines that would have popped out of that one and vilified law enforcement. But the reality is that mob situation could have resulted in the serious injury or death of a police officer. Now, let's go, as I said before, a lot of the comments that I make based on the news stories of the day, the most bizarre come out of California and New York, it seems. And here's a beauty. I have about as much respect for New York Mayor Bill de Blasio as I do for, I'm not even sure where I can go with that. Let me rephrase that. I have no respect for New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. I've watched him in action since he took office, and he's an idiot, and he's revealing his idiot tendencies once again. Here's the headline: New York mayor pushes to release armed robbery suspects without bail. Are you kidding me? See, the liberal theology, if you will. Is the mantra is jail reduction. We must end mass incarceration. And how do you end mass incarceration? Well, you release everybody. And that seems to be what de Blasio's theory is. So what he's done, he's made it easier for accused criminals to be released without bail. He's unveiled a plan to, quote, more than triple, unquote, the number of juvenile offenders who are freed from jail without bond, including some, quote, teen offenders facing charges of assault, armed robbery, and burglary. And here's this guy's quote. We're ensuring there are real alternatives to incarceration, particularly for our young New Yorkers, quote, unquote. And under the mayor's new guidelines for this beauty of a plan, which is already, by the way, going into effect within days. Offenders between the ages of 16 and 19 will qualify for the, quote, youth engagement track. Ah, well, it's all okay because he named it something that has a cool ring to it. The youth engagement track. The program was previously not available to 18 and 19-year-olds, because they are adults. But now, de Blasio is not even taking into account that these are adult members of society. These aren't your wide-eyed, innocent, juvenile offenders. These are all violent offenders. And they're not kids. They're adults. But what he is doing is he's trying to appease his liberal base by allowing violent offenders under the guise of, quote, youth, unquote, to get out of jail free. And let me explain the realities as a 34-year law enforcement officer. The reason for bail is to make sure that somebody appears for court. If you let them go, they have nothing, they have no skin in the game, they don't come back to court. So what, and so let's go even further. If there's a subject out there doing armed robberies, and you've just let him out without even having to post bail. What do you think is going to keep him from doing what he does, which is armed robberies? This is going to cost lives. There's not one shadow of a doubt that there are going to be these, quote, youthful, unquote, offenders who, once they get out of jail with, you know, no consequences, once again, they're going to go right back at it. And they're going to be somebody paying the price. You know who it is? It's going to be the police, and it's going to be the citizens. De Blasio doesn't care. He's got his armed contingent that goes with him wherever. So once again, the mayor of New York reveals his true colors. And they certainly aren't true blue. Much more going on that I can't wait to tell you about. This story is a doozy. Get your blood pressure medications out. The only good thing about this is there will be consequences. A judge, this is going to blow your mind. A judge in Massachusetts, a Massachusetts state judge, who was suspended without pay for helping an illegal immigrant drug suspect escape out of the back door of the courthouse, is demanding that her salary be reinstated while she faces trial. Oh yeah. So here's what happened. This judge, now she's been a judge for a significant amount of time. Her name is Shelley Richmond Joseph. And she and her court officer, Wesley McGregor, have both been charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice, obstruction of justice, aiding and abetting, and obstruction of a federal proceeding. And here's what these beauties did. They had a illegal alien who was facing felony charges. The ICE, that is Immigration Service, had tried to place a detainer on him. Now, this is a sanctuary state, and people in that area are not cooperating with law enforcement. So, in essence, where they normally would have taken this guy into custody was jail, and when he was due to be released, they would pick him up on a detainer. A detainer is merely, please notify us when you're going to release this guy so we can come pick him up or deal with him in some other way. This judge and the court officer found out that there was an immigration agent in the courthouse, in the courtroom, waiting for this guy's case to be adjudicated so that they could arrest him and deport him. This happens every day. But this judge decided she wasn't going to let it happen. So, unfortunately for her and the court officer and also a district attorney who was supposed to be prosecuting this felony suspect, they were recorded talking about how they were going to help this guy escape out the back door. And that's exactly what they did. They actually took him to the rear door of the courthouse and opened the door and said, fly and be free. Well, here's the good news here is that the Department of Justice lost their mind and said, you know what? Enough is enough. They presented it to a grand jury who indicted her and the court officer, and now they are facing prison time. And I can't tell you how happy I am that the federal government decided to do that, because they've been letting people get away with this nonsense way, way too long. This was a blatant escape that took place. And if a citizen did this, they'd be in prison for years. I just hope that this judge and the court officer get what they deserve and they go to prison. Now, can you imagine, first of all, the entitlement mentality of this judge to think that there were going to be no recriminations, there was going to be no accountability for aiding an escape. That's the power that these judges believe that they have. Clearly, she didn't think that she was going to be at risk. Well, guess what? It is time for your day of reckoning. And she is demanding that she be paid in the meantime. You can't talk about anything more entitled than this judge and what she has done. Well, by the way, the suspect who they helped escape, he's still on the loose, committing more crimes. Mm-hmm. Good job, Judge. Good job. Well, that'll about do it for us today here in the briefing room. There's never any shortage of topics to talk about, and we got a great guest waiting for you. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, you know, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And register with them. Contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a doctor of osteopathy, Matthew Levy. He is the chair of the nonprofit Stop the Bleeding Coalition, an organization dedicated to educating and advocating about the importance of early bleeding control. He serves as the associate professor of emergency medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He holds leadership roles with the Johns Hopkins Emergency Medicine's Division of Special Operations, as well as the EMS Fellowship. And I could go on and on, but I just want to welcome Dr. Matthew Levy to the show.
Well, thank you. And it's really an honor and pleasure to be here. And thank you for taking the time to dedicate some time and talk about this important topic.
This really is an important topic. And, you know, I have my audience is made up of law enforcement, but also of just, everyday citizens who support law enforcement or are interested about what's going on in their community. And Stop the Bleeding Coalition, this is an amazing effort that you're putting together or that you are part of. And it is it's a nationwide effort, and it literally has the ability to save untold lives. So let's talk about the effort and how it got started.
Well, that's great, Randy. And you know, I, again, thank you for the very warm welcome. First of all, to everyone listening, to our members of service, to our first responders and our law enforcement personnel on the front lines, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for what you do every day, fighting the fight, keeping our streets safe, keeping law and order, and you know, putting your own safety in harm's way. I stand very closely with law enforcement. I'm a core member of our faculty in our Center for Law Enforcement Medicine at Johns Hopkins, and work very closely with our law enforcement colleagues. So utmost of appreciation and respect to the audience for what you all do and just what, you know, the scope and the magnitude of the challenges and complexities of modern society. Now, with that said, let's talk about bleeding for a minute. Bleeding as a preventable cause of death in trauma patients represents the single biggest opportunity and cause of preventable trauma death. And you know, what that means is that there's real opportunity here. There's opportunity to identify life-threatening bleeding, and there's opportunity to do something about it, oftentimes before EMS arrives. And I'd like to talk about the discussion, given the unique topic here. I'd like to talk about it first and foremost from an officer survival perspective, but then also later on from the public perspective as well, because there's some nuances, differences, but there's also an important takeaway, I think, for all of our listeners.
Sure.
Or several, actually. So as I mentioned a moment ago, severe bleeding or bleeding or hemorrhage, the medical term, is the single biggest cause of preventable trauma death. Nearly a third of trauma deaths that occur before the patient gets to a hospital, nearly a third of all trauma deaths that occur are due to bleeding. And you know, not all bleeding is life threatening. And I think we probably can conceptualize that there's non-life-threatening bleeding, but there is brisk, severe bleeding. And when that's happening, every second counts. And as time goes by, once a critical amount of that blood volume is lost in the body, the symptoms and the disease of shock sets in. And at that point, in some cases, it's too little too late. You know, I can think of any number of examples and images come to mind of just how time critical this is. But when we talk about the Stop the Bleed initiative as a whole, and we talk about this, it is intimately tied to officer survival, intimately tied to what our members of the military services experienced over the past 25 years of armed conflict, and the modern day science and understanding behind why this is so important comes actually from many military lessons learned in a battlefield. And those lessons learned became apparent that if people could recognize severe bleeding and do something about it right away, let's talk about the military model for a second, before the corpsman or the medic were to get there, the chances of survival went way, way, way up. And the opposite was true. If people waited for medical care, for formal medical care to occur, then those chances went way, way, survival went way down. So in the background of all this, was a movement and initiative that many of your listeners are probably familiar with, known as Tactical Combat Casualty Care, TCCC, as it's affectionately learned or known. And that movement really focused on training every person going downrange in theater to how to recognize and do something about severe bleeding, and giving them the right equipment, giving them tourniquets, giving them wound packing materials, and also empowering them to do something about it. So on the heels of these lessons learned, transitioning now to the non-military world, particularly the civilian law enforcement world, in the space that is what we call tactical medicine or operational medicine, we've been translating this for some time now, well over a decade, and it started with us focusing on our high-risk law enforcement special operations missions and making sure that our operators were properly trained and equipping them with tourniquets and sometimes called IFACs or blowout kits, whatever term you want to use for an individualized first aid kit that could have this life-saving equipment on it. And that movement through the work of some of my colleagues, and I can't nor won't take credit for it, but through the hard work of some of my colleagues working with organizations like the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association and other leadership organizations around the country, have been advocating for the training of all law enforcement officers, patrol, undercover, uniform, plainclothes, doesn't matter, not just those relegated to or who are focused on special operations law enforcement.
From my perspective, I actually began my career way before being a police officer. I was a member of the first aid and rescue squad in a small community, and that's where I learned the basic techniques of first aid. And even as a civilian, it was very apparent that you could train people that were from all walks of life. But when you get into the law enforcement world, I think that we have seen a much more comprehensive effort on the part of agencies to recognize that this training is absolutely essential.
I think that's spot on. And I think we, in the year 2019, are far better aligned from a law enforcement perspective and the perspective of officer resilience and the survival mentality, the warrior mentality, call it whatever you like, to not only we're better trained and aware of it, but we're trained as to how to better handle it. And that's probably a great great segue. So there's a lot of work that's been done on education and training and preparedness and helping our officers recognize from a self-care, buddy care perspective what to do. But even beyond that, the opportunity is even greater. The opportunity behind, or the concept behind Stop the Bleed, is so that everybody in society knows what to do. And if everyone in society knew how to do CPR and knew how to recognize and control severe bleeding and maybe one or two other things, think about how much more of a resilient society we would have. Think about how much more intrinsic capability, both from an intentional situation, such as an attack or an assailant event, or an unintentional situation like a tornado or any number of other natural disasters. And so that's really the concept behind Stop the Bleed, is how do we empower people to do this? And you know, what's fascinating, Randy, is that people, this thing is spreading and picking up so much momentum, far more than we could have ever imagined, and to the point where people recognize that there's a need and a vulnerability. And as you touched on it, people are intrinsically willing to want to learn this stuff, and those who do have that empowerment to help one another. So we're really, at the end of the day, one of the founding fathers, if you will, of the Stop the Bleed initiative, will say this is really about resilience. This is really about how do we make ourselves and our society better capable of adapting to whatever's thrown our way to help one another. And there's all kinds of derivatives of that we could talk about later. But the fundamental concept is that we have minutes that are precious and irrecoverable from the moment severe bleeding happens. And even in the most sophisticated response scenarios, and even in the most well-engineered and highly efficient public safety systems, it can still take minutes, up 2, 3, 5, 7 minutes for the first wave of responders to get there. And in a law enforcement situation, I don't have to tell your audience, there are competing responsibilities and priorities: threat neutralization, scene control, all these other things. But as additional waves of resources get there, and we have an opportunity to start to take a look at the next level of what needs to be done on scene, it's now how do we help those who are in most imminent danger of dying? And severe bleeding we believe is the core element there. Now, I want to be very transparent and very careful in saying there are people who have made the very hardened association between Stop the Bleed and active shooter events. And there clearly is an association, but it's this, there is, you know, without getting into forensics and ballistic patterns of injury, let's just say that there are lots of things that happen during these complex active assailant events that where stop the bleed may not actually help the individual, but there are people there who could benefit from that. So it's not going to save everybody, and we fully acknowledge that. But if there's an opportunity to render immediate aid and temporize life-threatening shock from starting in, then that's what we're after here.
There's no panacea. I mean, there isn't a blanket answer to all of the questions. But this what you are describing to me is about people helping people, and I think that Americans as a whole are willing to step in. I mean, we've seen it how often. I mean, even there was a school shooting yesterday, and it was the students who one student died as a result because he tried to take down one of the shooters, but the other students jumped on the guy, on one of the shooters, and there's a willingness amongst Americans to get involved. So there's a lot to talk about here. How did this initiative get started?
So if we were to look back about 5 years or so at the birth of the Stop the Bleed initiative, I think it was the output of the convergence of several different things. The military lessons learned from combat and the translation of those lessons learned to civilian and law enforcement, to civilian society, including our law enforcement community, was felt to be a great opportunity. Somewhat coincidentally timed was the horrific tragedy at Sandy Hook in Connecticut. And in the aftermath of that, people began, in many people's minds, was a pivotal event because it was of such magnitude. And people began asking the question of what more could have been done and what can we do to prepare better for the next time. And I have to, again, be very transparent with saying, no one is saying Stop the Bleed is going to save everyone, but it is an opportunity for us to have instant force multipliers on scene, instant extra hands who know what to do if it's just hold pressure here. And so I think that the convergence of things really was around the time of Sandy Hook, and then not very long in proximity to that was the Boston bombing event. And now we have this incredibly highly publicized event that occurred at arguably one of the world's most notorious sporting events, the Boston Marathon. And right at the finish line, you see people with these incredibly challenging and horrific injuries that were once thought to be relegated to the battlefield. And I think there were a series of events like that that occurred where people began asking the question, what can be done? What can we do? What can we ask of people to do? What do we want them to know to do? And it took what was, in my mind, and this is my own personal opinion, and I should have started off with that disclaimer at the start of the interview. My opinions today are those of mine and do not represent any academic or law enforcement agency I'm affiliated with. I just have the usual disclaimers, or government agencies for that matter. But what I would say is you know, what we began to realize is as these events are occurring, you know, people are there. People are actually rendering aid. As you said, people are going to try to do something. I think of the events, the complex attacks, that occurred in Paris, and the talks that were coming in of the responders there literally taking their belts off in the streets to fabricate and improvise a tourniquet. By the way, using a belt to make a tourniquet is one of the least effective ways to do it, but that's neither here nor there.
Sounds a little Hollywoodish.
Yeah. Listen, that Sam Brown belt does its job around your waist. It's not gonna be an effective circumferential compression device, but that's another story for another interview. What I would say is there was a series of events that occurred in a unique time sequence that really raised attention. And there were a number of organizations that began looking at this. The government was looking at it from a way to foster national preparedness and resilience. There was interest in obviously people have heard of Run, Hide, Fight as a kind of a stop, drop, and roll, or a catchy way of remembering and helping people learn what to do during an assailant event or an active event. Those things in my mind are defensive postures, right? So up until the fight portion, And that's a last resort, obviously. And by the way, you mentioned a moment ago, just yesterday, there was another event that occurred, and you said a young student, literally in an effort to subdue the attacker, his tragic life was lost. The same thing happened last week at a college, at a university, in another part of the country. So these events keep happening. And I think that, that it is this ever present and what feels observationally and statistically like an increase in these complex events, let's just call them that, whether they're active assailant, whether they're lone gunman, active shooter, whether they're coordinated, but these complex response scenarios, that in this increase of them, people want to know what can they do. The ability to recognize and control severe bleeding is one thing we can teach. Now, there are people out there who would say we should teach lots of people some other things too. I wouldn't argue with them, but I would say there's a bandwidth issue, right? How much can we expect the lay public to do, right? So for the officers that I work with in my communities that I have medical relationships with, as a medical director, as a physician oversight, you know, we talk about other things besides just tourniquet application and wound packing. We talk about chest seals and stuff like that. But what can you really expect the general public to do in a reproducible large scale way, and do so in those first moments following an event where we're going to affect survival? And that's what this is really all about. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I think it's really a confluence of several different issues.
Okay, so let me ask you this. I've taken a number of first aid, if you will, classes during both my years prior to joining the police department, and then some emergency medicine classes after as a first responder. What does this training actually look like?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So what we're talking about with Stop the Bleed training is there are several classes that have emerged that have fully embraced the concept of Stop the Bleed training. One of the most well-known ones, that there are things such as I mentioned earlier, the TCCC Tactical Combat Casualty Care class, or the Tactical Emergency Casualty Care class, and the American Red Cross has a class, and the American College of Surgeons has a class that is very well known because it's a one-hour kind of in and out class where you get the information, you get some hands-on practice. So regardless of who's, and I'm not going to, you know, endorse one class or the other, they're all very good classes. The concept is giving some type of a structured lesson where people understand why severe bleeding is a problem. They understand what the signs and symptoms are of severe bleeding. In other words, here's what severe bleeding looks like. Here's what is not severe bleeding by comparison. And here's what you do about it. And what you do about it depends largely on where the bleeding is coming from in the body. If it's coming from an extremity, the answer is we get a tourniquet on it, if it's a severe bleeding. And I should mention, the courses also spend a moment describing what are not just the signs of severe bleeding, but some of the other things that may go into it, such as the signs of someone who's going into shock and stuff like that. But the actual real guts of the course, forgive the pun, is really about where is the severe bleeding on the body and what are you going to do about it? And what you're going to do about it depends upon what you have with you. So the class, all this training, really, all these classes really center on the fact that you got to do something and you got to use whatever you have. And if all you have are your hands, guess what? That's what we want you to use. We would prefer that you use hands with gloves on them or with some kind of a barrier, but we'll take what we can get, because if we do nothing, that person is going to die. If they have bleeding control resources with them, like a tourniquet or wound packing material or gauze or dressings, then it comes down to where specifically the bleeding is. If it's on an extremity, the course teaches them how to apply a tourniquet. The courses usually go through the most common tourniquets that are commonly out there. There's actually more and more making their way onto the market. But the concept is, here's a tourniquet, here's how you would use it, and why we really feel very strongly for the lay public that they should be leaning towards manufactured tourniquets that are, you know, the ones that are what we call purpose-derived, or that are manufactured for the purpose of being an arterial tourniquet, not necessarily improvising tourniquets.
Let me interrupt you here. So
yeah.
is this training standardized? That is, so if I'm in California, I'm going to get the same training as if I'm in New Jersey. Is it the same training course?
It depends upon which. There are several courses that are out there. I think probably the most common course that's being used and delivered is the American College of Surgeons Bleeding Control Basics course, which is a course that's been developed by our colleagues, the American College of Surgeons, the trauma surgeons, and their robust network of trauma centers. They've developed this course to teach this. So that course is very much standardized, as are the other larger, more common courses that tend to be a little bit longer in duration. But as long as you're taking a course that's from one of the names I mentioned, you're apt to get a very similar reproducible product. The second part of this course, and actually is also, what do you do if you don't have a tourniquet available, or if the wound is on a part of the body that is just not amenable to the application of a tourniquet? The groin, the armpit, the neck, the places we call the junction, where the extremities connect to the torso, because you can't get a tourniquet that high, or you can't get a tourniquet, obviously you don't want to put one tourniquet around somebody's neck. So these courses also do teach, the proper way.
Maybe my ex-wife.
Well, yeah. Maybe. Yeah, I think we all know somebody who we'd like to test the theory on, but all kidding aside, we have to be very, very transparent about that, because this is for the general public, and we have to make sure that they know that, because it may not be, well, we all know about common sense, right? It may not become common sense to some. So the point is, and the answer to your question is, these initiatives, these courses that are being taught are standardized. And are meant to be for that reason. So if you're looking to bring the Stop the Bleed training to your community, to your department, to your region, I would highly recommend that the listeners go with one of the recognized courses that are out there that are going to teach, that are developed by academicians and developed by people with experts in content development, that are going to teach this material properly. And I can give you the link for our website.
Well, I want to get to that. But so we're asking citizens, in essence, to get involved, to get some knowledge, to get a certain skill set that in the event that they are in a situation where there is someone bleeding, they can step in and help. What is the time factor involved here? Are these training courses the same length? I mean, what kind of time commitment are we asking of these people in order to get this training?
And, therein lies one of the real challenges. We're asking people to give their time, and most people will give you 30 minutes to an hour. Much more than that, they're not, now we're asking really people to take away something else from their day for this. And some will do it, but not everyone's going to. So the majority of these courses, the majority of them, that this material can be taught and delivered in a structured manner in less than an hour. That's really what we're after. We think that's really the sweet spot. Now I've taught hundreds of Stop the Bleed courses at this point, and we can get the course in and out with less than an hour. Now there are scalability issues. It's one thing if I'm going to teach a church or a civic group with 100 people in it, I can give that lecture to 1,000 people. That's not the issue. But when it comes down to actually the hands-on portion, that's where you need to keep the numbers and the ratios appropriate, so you can have instructors in small groups doing the skills demonstration, getting everybody the actual hands-on time practice. And that's where they're, for larger training events, and one of the things we'll talk about later in the interview is National Stop the Bleed Day. But for larger training events, that requires a little more coordination. But in my community, when we do Stop the Bleed classes, now we do them in under an hour. And the whole idea is to get this knowledge to people either during a lunch break at work or during a breakout session after their civic group meeting or their church meeting or their religious group meeting, or getting them, so that we're not taking too much out of people's day and times. Because
excellent, yeah. Time is a very precious thing here. We've only got a few minutes left. So first of all, where if people want to get involved, if they want to take this course, where do they get this information?
So the timing of the interview is really important, because National Stop the Bleed Day, which is a day that we designated to raise awareness and to get as many people involved in Stop the Bleed as possible, is coming up real soon. And so one thing they can do is they can go to nationalstopthebleedday.org as a website. National Stop the Bleed Day, by the way, if I haven't mentioned it, is May 23rd. And so they can go to nationalstopthebleedday.org, and they can find out more information there. They can also find out additional information by going to the Stop the Bleeding Coalition website, which is stopthebleedingcoalition.org, and we have links directly to the National Stop the Bleed Day efforts. And then there are other organizations that I would encourage the listeners to reach out to, such as the American College of Surgeons through their website called bleedingcontrol.org. But if you get to any of those websites, they will be able to find out more information about how to get trained and how to get involved, particularly ahead of National Stop the Bleed Day, because we're trying to raise awareness. We're trying to get this information into as many people as we possibly can, and to do what we can to improve survival from and decrease preventable deaths from trauma.
I think this is a tremendous effort. More and more people have been trained in CPR. More and more people have been given some survival training, if you will, especially law enforcement officers. But it's the American public that you never know when an event is going to occur. We've seen it with terrorism. We've seen it with mass shootings. We've seen it with traffic accidents. We've seen it with all kinds of tragedies that occur. And wouldn't you rather have that little bit of knowledge that might save the life of another human being? And so what this effort is doing, Stop the Bleed, is literally giving people the skills to play a role and touch the lives of other people in the most dramatic way possible.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, this is really about people saving people. And, you know, one of the salient or secondary motivators behind the Stop the Bleed initiative is the placement of these kits throughout society, airports, shopping malls, high traffic places like theaters or auditoriums or stadium or concert venues. So that other people there, be them off-duty public safety, be them healthcare professionals, also have access to the equipment to help save more lives. So it's a lot about knowledge. It's a lot about information. It's also about equipment and resources too.
Well, once again, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. And what's the main website that you would direct people to?
Let's have everybody go to nationalstopthebleedday.org. That's one word. And they can go to nationalstopthebleedday.org. They can find out all the information they need. And then
participate in National Stop the Bleed Day.
That's the hope. The hope is that that you'll get trained and then help us train others, because that's the only way we're going to reach 300 million people.
Well, that's a lofty goal, my friend.
Well, 300 million. We got to start somewhere. We're well on our way.
I love it. Thanks again, Dr. Levy, for coming on to Blue Lives Radio. And I really do applaud your cause and your efforts.
Well, thank you for having me. And thank you all from the bottom of my heart for what you and your audience do every day.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we have the unfortunate duty to let you know which law enforcement officers died in the line of duty. We call this our End of Watch segment. This week, I have three names to read. The first is Police Officer Jesus Marrero Martinez of the Manatee Police Department in Puerto Rico. Police Officer Jesus Marrero Martinez was shot and killed while intervening in a carjacking attempt while off duty. He and a friend had gone to a club in Vega Baja, not realizing it was closed. When they arrived in the parking lot, they were confronted by three masked men who demanded their car keys. His friend relinquished his keys, but Officer Marrero Martinez identified himself as a police officer and drew his weapon. He shot and killed one of the subjects in an exchange of gunfire. A second subject shot him in the back and the arm. He succumbed to those injuries. The two remaining subjects then fled the scene. Officer Marrero Martinez has served with the Manatee Municipal Police for 16 years. He is survived by his wife and four children. Police Officer Jesus Marrero Martinez, Manatee Municipal Police, Puerto Rico, End of Watch, Saturday, May 25th, 2019. 2019. The second is Lieutenant Joseph Johnson of the Seminole Police Department Tribal Police. Lieutenant Joe Johnson was killed in a vehicle crash on U.S. Highway 27 near Palm Beach County. He was driving between two Seminole Indian reservations at 10:20 p.m. when his vehicle left the roadway and overturned into an adjacent canal. The rescue personnel removed him from his vehicle and transported him to St. Mary's Medical Center, where he passed away a short time later. Lieutenant Johnson was a United States Army veteran of the Vietnam War and had served with the Seminole Police for 10 years. He had previously served with the Collier County Sheriff's Office for 25 years and with the Henry County Sheriff's Office for 5 years. He is survived by his wife, 2 children, and 3 grandchildren. Lieutenant Joseph Johnson, Seminole Police, Tribal Police. End of watch, Thursday, May 30th, 2019. And the third is Lieutenant Stephen Wittstein of the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office in Louisiana. Lieutenant Stephen Wittstein was killed in an automobile crash on Port Hudson Pride Road between Munson Drive and Pine Oak Lane in Zachary at 6:30 a.m. He was en route to the sheriff's office when his patrol car left the roadway, struck a tree, and overturned. He suffered fatal injuries as a result of the collision. His canine partner suffered minor injuries and was treated at a local veterinarian. Lieutenant Wittstein has served with the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office for 8 years. Previously, he had served with the Baker Police for 9 years. He is survived by his wife and children. Lieutenant Stephen Wittstein, East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office, Louisiana. End of watch, Thursday, May 30th, 2019. May they rest in peace. I want to thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. We try to bring you the truth about the American law enforcement officer and the stories that are written and reported about them. I also would love for you to come onto Facebook and look me up under the voice of American law enforcement, like me, follow me. And if you haven't, please check out the website that goes along with our organization, The Wounded Blue. It's thewoundedblue.org. This is a charitable organization that assists injured and disabled law enforcement officers. And if you haven't seen our film, go to either iTunes or Amazon or the Microsoft Store and look up The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. Thanks again for tuning in. We will see you next week right here on The Voice of American Law Enforcement.